This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Chef Ken Mishka says there's a reason all the Epiphany Farms restaurants have different food themes, to use diverse foods from their farm.
When you utilize the entire animal, nose to tail, it's very challenging to have an engineered menu that uses all of the cuts.
The latest Epiphany Farms restaurant, Bakery and Pickle, is about to open. Mary Cullen takes a visit. We'll have a few big questions about plans to dissolve the Bloomington Election Commission and another great story from the Next to Normal Story Slam. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Republicans and libertarians are trying to kill the Bloomington Election Commission, or BEC. It's not the first time someone's wanted to do that. After all, it's a little odd that Bloomington has its own election authority when everyone else in the county votes through the county clerk's office. Barring a successful challenge by Denise Williams, the 1,300 signatures collected by Republicans and libertarians will be enough to put a question on November's ballot. It'll ask Bloomington voters if they want to dissolve the BEC. That would fold its election duties into the county clerk's office, currently Republican Kathy Michael. GLT spoke to about a half dozen lawyers from around the state, plus local officials, to clear up confusion about how it might work. First question, why to do it? The argument from those who want to dissolve the BEC is that it's inefficient to have two separate election authorities with two staffs, two sets of equipment, two websites, etc. They also say it's potentially confusing to voters who have to figure out which election authority serves them. Here's McLean County Republican Party Chair Connie Beard, one of the lead organizers of the referendum push.
Well, I'm excited that we have been able to have a nonpartisan effort to serve the voters of McLean County.
Opposing it are local Democrats, including McLean County Board Member Eric Rankin, also Democratic Party Chair.
Most of our party does tend to believe that the Bloomington election can be eliminated. They're not against that. The problem is that the Bloomington Election Commission being deleted and then rolled immediately into the county clerk's office is not something that any of the Democrats support.
They say that's because it's partisan, meaning the office holder is a Republican, Democrat, or another party. They say a nonpartisan, professionally managed, so meaning not elected, countywide election commission would better serve voters. Democratic County Board Member Carlo Rubestelli says it's not about current county clerk Kathy Michael, a Republican. He says he'd feel the same way if Democratic challenger Nikita Richards beat Michael in November.
And that's one of the things that I am worried most about, is the perception that somehow a partisan in office, whether it's Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, whatever, would somehow not represent or not administer an election fairly or transparently or openly.
In addition to Bloomington, there are a handful of city election commissions across Illinois, including Chicago, Rockford, and Galesburg. But there are only two county election commissions, Peoria and DuPage. And DuPage's is being dissolved January 1st, with duties folding into the county clerk's office. That's expected to save $300,000 annually. County clerks do it everywhere else. Kathy Michael, the county clerk, supports asking voters to dissolve the BEC. She says voters should have a say in who runs elections, and a commission removes that. So how do you create a countywide election commission? That's where it gets tricky. Those who collected the 1,300 signatures for the referendum aren't doing it specifically to create a countywide election commission later. Libertarians, at least, are not ruling out that possibility, though they don't currently hold any seats on the McLean County Board. Local party chairman Steve C. says he might support a countywide commission if it were cost neutral. But he says the first step, anyway, is to still pass that referendum. Cease is basically right. Six lawyers interviewed by GLT this month say state law doesn't provide much flexibility. For counties that have a city election commission somewhere within it, you need to dissolve that first before you go countywide with a new one. Here's Rick Venstra, lawyer for the city of Aurora, where voters decided in March to dissolve the Aurora Election Commission.
Now, my review of the election code suggests that only counties that do not have a city with an election commission, unless the legislature is specifically authorized to do that, can create a countywide election commission.
Next question, who can create a countywide election commission? If the BEZ were dissolved in November, the McLennan County Board could then move to create a countywide election commission, though there are no signs it plans to do that. Alternatively, voters themselves could do it by referendum. They'd need at least 1,000 voter signatures, similar to the process by which the BEC referendum was pursued. Another gray area, can you kill the BEC and create a countywide commission simultaneously? Two questions on the same ballot, side by side. Most election lawyers interviewed by GLT say no, or at least it's not advisable. Jessica Woods, McLean County First Assistant State's Attorney in the Civil Division, says she doesn't think that's legal. Others are similarly skeptical. Carrie Lynn Kraftheffer is a lawyer and election law expert based in Naperville. Her firm has represented BEC previously, but is not involved in Williams' case.
Well, the challenge with that is, what if you have people vote no to dissolve Bloomington and yes to create countywide? Yeah, then you have a conflict. So, I mean, since right now there isn't anything that would allow them, it seems like they don't have the authority to put it on, the county wouldn't have the ability to put it on the ballot right now as long as the city one exists. So I don't think they could put both of those on at the same time.
There is one other option. Local officials could ask lawmakers in Springfield to change state law to make it easier to simultaneously kill the BEC and create a new countywide commission without election duties ever being handed over to the county clerk's office. Other communities have done that, winning carve-outs in the notoriously vague 73-line, 1,400-word slice of state statute that governs how election commissions are birthed and die. That's what DuPage County did. That bill was signed by the governor July 23rd. That's what Peoria did, allowing them to eliminate the Peoria Election Commission and immediately establish a Peoria County Election Commission in its place. That relic of Peoria's change still exists in state law, with a not-so-subtle carve-out for, quote, any county with a population of less than 200,000, but more than 175,000 persons as of the 2010 census. McLean County's 2010 population, by the way, was 169,000, so just under that threshold. Carla Robustelli, the Democratic County Board member, says this legislative carve-out approach should be seriously considered.
I think we haven't done enough to explore our options. We have never added that to our legislative agenda. And so I just want Bloomington voters to know that there isn't support by those that are elected historically and currently, and by those passing this petition, to create a McLean County Election Commission.
At this point, if you're thinking, boy, state election law sounds confusing, it's because it is. Here's Ross Seckler, lawyer and election law expert with Odelson Stirk near Chicago, who worked on the Aurora case.
It's definitely a difficult and vague area that hasn't, because I think it hasn't necessarily been updated too much, especially the Municipal Board of Election Commissioners sections of the code. As you can tell, it's a bit of an odd, very often untouched area of election law.
Perhaps one of the most substantive questions we can ask here is whether a countywide commission can ever really be nonpartisan. The DuPage Election Commission, the one that's being killed January 1st, had its three members appointed by the DuPage County Board Chairman, a partisan. Two of the three had to be from the county's two majority political parties, that's the Democrats and the Republicans. Chicago's Board of Election Commissioners and the Peoria County Election Commission work a bit differently. The circuit court picks those commissioners, but again, judges are generally elected. The BEC works the same way. Three commissioners appointed by the courts, two Republicans, one Democrat. A Democrat, by the way, is Denise Williams, the one challenging those signatures. Here's Scott Uller, a lawyer and election law expert with Klein, Thorpe, and Jenkins in Chicago.
Sounds like the Democrats that are opposed to this want a, I don't know what that would be, a nonpartisan, I don't know how you achieve something where there are no political connections to the entity at all.
Robustelli says he doesn't have a strong opinion yet about how commissioners would be appointed to this hypothetical McLean County Election Commission he wants to create. So how can they be nonpartisan?
Each individual person, of course, can have their own political beliefs and opinions. But I think it's very different when you have a professional administrator, somebody whose job it is every single day with he or she staff to wake up thinking about how best to get more people registered, how best to, where is the best location for precincts, how we can exchange information and make information more dynamic on our website. When you think about this is as much about perception as it is reality.
That's McLean County Board Member Carlo Rubestelli. The hearing is set for Monday on Williams' challenge. The judge's final decision on whether it makes the ballot is required by August 30th. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Connect Transit. Get connected with Connect Transit 7 days a week. Riders can track buses in real time with the Connect Transit app for Android or iPhone. Information at connect-transit.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Coming up in a bit, Mary Collin visits the latest restaurant opening from Epiphany Farms. But first, Mothers Against Drunk Driving has found a new advocate who understands firsthand the pain that drunk drivers can cause. Allison Size was a junior at Illinois State University in 2014 when she was injured in the crash that killed Michael Collins at the hands of a drunk driver. Size is now a program coordinator for Mothers Against Drunk Driving of Illinois. As Illinois launches a new Saturation Saturday campaign aimed at preventing drivers from getting behind the wheel and drunk, Size shares her story with GLT's Eric Stock.
In March of 2014, I was actually a junior here at Illinois State, and my friends and I made the responsible decision to call a designated driver to get home after going out one night. But unfortunately, another woman did not, and my friends and I were hit by a drunk driver traveling over 130 miles per hour, which unfortunately took the life of my friend Michael Collins, who is a senior here at ISU. Since that time, I really wanted to use my voice to make a difference. I didn't want to be just another statistic. So I've been volunteering with Mothers Against Drunk Driving in some capacity since then, and I now serve as their program coordinator for the whole state.
And Michael Collins, a case that has gained national attention because of his focus on helping so many other causes, and the Pay It Forward movement stemmed from that. What did you learn about that experience and going through that, not only the accident, but the response that followed and also the sentence that the drunk driver received?
So definitely there's a lot to learn in that situation. And even when I'm going in and talking to classrooms and students now, they ask me, what can we learn from you? Unfortunately, in our situation, we did everything correct and we were still struck with this tragedy. So the number one thing I tell people is they have to be willing to intervene and either stop a friend or a stranger from getting in the car, who's someone who has been drinking, or to take the keys from a friend who may try to drive after drinking. But I also just learned a lot about the law system and the severity of the crimes and the punishment that comes with it. The drunk driver in our case received 14 years. She did plead guilty. And, you know, that's justice in the case. That's justice in the court's eyes. Unfortunately, nothing's ever going to bring Michael back or anyone who's been impacted by impaired driving. My friends and I still live with the memories and the impact of the crash as well. But it's something, definitely a life-altering experience. And like I said, it really lit a fire in me to want to make a difference. I didn't want Michael or Tawny or Sam or myself just to be another statistic. And I hope to use that experience and my voice to make a difference.
And you sustained minor injuries and was out of the hospital after a day?
Correct. Yep. My injuries were minor, thankfully. I had a concussion, dislocated shoulder, some broken ribs, cuts and bruises. But a lot of the injury comes in the non-physical form. It's the survivor's guilt. It's the wondering why, especially, like I said, in our case, my friends and I called the designated driver. So one of the hardest things to understand is when we make the responsible decisions, why did this happen to us? And like I said, that's a question I get asked in schools all the time when students say, you did everything right, so what are we supposed to do?
Does it change your perspective when you go out on the road now?
It does. I know distracted driving obviously is becoming a huge issue with people texting and on their phones, but if I see someone swerve or look a little off, automatically I think they're drunk or that there are drunk drivers on the road. Statistics show that there are many, many people who are driving drunk every day, and so it's scary to know that you're sharing the road with people who are impaired, and that can happen to you even if you are doing the right thing on the road.
Matt has reported the statistic of 300,000 drunk driving incidents in the U.S., every day. So odds are there is a drunk driver sharing the road with you at any given time. I guess if you really think about it, it'd probably scare people from even going out on the road at all, knowing that there are impaired drivers out there.
Correct. And with that statistic, about 28 people are killed every day by drunk driving. So no matter where you are, your car is considered a weapon. You know, if you're not using it responsibly, if you're not Making sure you're sober, if you're not wearing your seatbelt, the car can be a very deadly weapon and a deadly force. So it's scary to think that even if you do everything right, statistics show that you can still be impacted by other people's decisions out there.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock, visiting with Allison Size, who's the program coordinator for Mothers Against Driving of Illinois. And that brings us to an event this weekend that Matt is helping to promote, and that is Saturation Saturday, as local, county, and state police are boosting traffic enforcement from the evening hours on Saturday through the morning hours on Sunday. Allison, how will this enforcement effort compare with, say, a typical weekend or, say, Labor Day weekend next week?
Good question. So this actually is a good kickoff for Labor Day weekend. I think sometimes drivers on the road expect it at certain times, especially around holidays. But to put this emphasis on the weekend before and just any weekend really shows the seriousness that law enforcement is taking on this cause. Like I said, drunk driving takes a lot of people's lives. It also injures 290,000 people a year. So to have this joint force between Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Illinois Department of Transportation, and local, county, and state law enforcement is huge. It really shows the seriousness that we take in this issue and that there's no excuse to be driving impaired.
A normal police also planning a regional roll call for participating agencies in central Illinois on Saturday night. What has the response been from police to get behind this effort, knowing that they're likely bringing officers in on overtime to handle this?
The response has been wonderful. We have between 60 and 70 agencies RFP'd right now, and I know there's a couple rolling in actually on my drive here, so I'm sure, you know, we're going to hit the 100 mark or even over 100 within the next couple of days still before Saturday. So the response has been wonderful. Law enforcement obviously wants to get out there. Multiple agencies are adding additional officers. Some are adding, you know, up to 5 officers on that night shift solely to focus on DUI. And again, that shows the seriousness that they are taking with this cause. Normal, for instance, I believe, is holding a sobriety checkpoint, which again is another step just to show that there's no excuse and no tolerance, zero tolerance for driving impaired.
Now, efforts like this certainly bring the problem of drunk driving to people's attention. Do you feel the police are able to give drunk driving sufficient attention throughout the year because there's so many other incidents and cases that they get involved with?
I believe so. We have in town here the Michael Collins Foundation, which Michael's parents started in honor of him. And every year we give out law enforcement awards. There was just a Bloomington police officer a couple years ago who had, I believe, over 100 DUIs in a year. So law enforcement officers do take this seriously. They are focusing on it, not just around holidays, not just on certain initiatives, but year long.
Looking at it from the legislative level now, Illinois 20 years ago became the 15th state to lower its legal drinking age from 0.10 to 0.08. They were just the 15th state at the time, and now all 50 states have lowered the bar, so to speak. And they say since then that traffic deaths caused by DUIs have dropped more than 40%. Did you expect it to make that much of a difference, and could there possibly be other factors in why that fatality rate is lowered?
Obviously, any reason that the fatality rate is lowered is wonderful, and we are glad to see that and hear that and hope it continues to drop. But I think regardless of the legal drinking age or regardless of the legal BAC, people are going to drink irresponsibly. If they want to break the law, they're going to do that regardless what the law is. But hopefully we keep taking steps forward and seeing those fatality rates drop.
Are there other ideas, other types of legislation that MAD is behind or could get behind to lower that rate further?
So MAD does do research into, it's called DADS, Driver Alcohol Detection Safety System, I believe is what it stands for. And they also push for interlock systems. So for first-time DUI offenders, they should have an interlock system in their car, meaning they would have to blow and make sure they have a low enough BAC to even start their car. So it's little steps like that and moving forward with the technology side of things that are really going to make the difference.
The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has reported while there are fewer drunk drivers on the road, there are more drivers impaired by drugs in recent years, such as marijuana, even prescription and over-the-counter medications that could impair their driving. How much has MAD looked into this, and what is MAD's response?
So MAD actually has altered their mission in the last couple years to not only focus on ending drunk driving, but to fight drug driving. It's unfortunate that drivers on the road think that they are less impaired, maybe by marijuana or some type of drug rather than alcohol, but it's all an impairment. It all alters their ability to respond and their ability to see distances and be able to drive responsibly and correctly. So MAD definitely is taking a stance against not only drunk driving, but drug driving.
As we talked about at the beginning, Allison, this is a cause that means a great deal to you on a personal level. How do you feel you're making a difference?
In my perspective, as long as one person can choose not to drink and drive or have the courage and bravery to stop a friend or stop a stranger from getting behind the wheel, then there is success. Thankfully, I have had people come up to me after presentations saying that because of my story, because of Michael or because of other friends who I talk about who have lost their life to impaired driving, that person will make sure they drive responsibly from now on and always have a designated driver. So it's hearing those stories and knowing that at least one person's life can be saved, that's success in my mind.
Size notes that MAD's victim service specialist advocated for 302 victims and their families following DUI crashes last year. MAD is on pace to top that mark this year. She spoke with Eric Stock. This is Sound Ideas.
Long summer days are upon us, and they seem primed for making memories. You can have a cookout, go to the pool, or get away to the beach. Wherever you go this summer, take NPR with you. Don't get burned by missing midterm election news. For context and analysis while you tan, listen to All Things Considered and hear the bigger picture every afternoon.
And there's Central Illinois News. I'm All Things Considered host Mike McCurdy. Join me from 3 to 6 p.m. for All Things Considered on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Epiphany Farms is opening its latest restaurant. Chefs Stu Hummel and Ken Mishka say Bakery and Pickle in downtown Bloomington will have baked goods and, well, pickles, too, at a speakeasy-style bar. In this interview with Mary Collin, Hummel and Mishka say they're going for a 20s Prohibition-era vibe.
We wanted it to feel kind of hidden and kind of like excluded in a little bit of ways. We wanted people to walk by and think that it's just a closed bakery or an antique shop. And then the guests that engage with us and who are fans of the experiences that we've been able to craft can push beyond the marketplace and enter this like kind of new restaurant world. And we've been pretty creative with the way that the meal is executed. And so it's going to be a lot different than a traditional experience.
So Epiphany Farms restaurants are becoming more and more diverse, specializing in sushi to the soon-to-be Korean barbecue. What's the challenge in tackling so many food types?
First of all, operating restaurants are one of the most challenging things that I think anybody could take on, as well as operating full-go farms. But we want to be able to offer different experiences and completely different concepts to the community, rather than having the cookie-cutter Italian restaurant that you see popping up every other weekend. Epiphany Farms is all about creating experiences and selling a feeling rather than just food. So with the Bakery and Pickle, we wanted to create something that was very unique. And we almost have two experiences that you can have here. One being a private supper club where you come in and have a booked experience, or you could go for the late night post 9 p.m. experience. And that's the rowdy bar crowd coming in and having fun with a limited a la carte menu.
Don't companies usually seek economies of scale rather than variety? And how does your experience offering change your perspective on that?
Quality over quantity. I think there's two things that have played into our decision to diversify our menu mixes and our concepts. The one is that when we started studying agriculture and studying how we were going to farm, we realized that we wanted to be organic, sustainable, regenerative farmers. And in order to do that, you need to have a very diverse landscape. So we don't just plant, you know, corn or sweet corn or just beans or just potatoes. We plant a very diverse amount of crops. And with that, restaurants, when you design menus, use only a very specific amount of things. And so by having different concepts, we are able to increase the amount of variety and diversity that our farm is planting. So that's one thing. The other thing is that when you utilize the entire animal, nose to tail, whether it's beef, goats, pigs, or chickens, it's very challenging to have an engineered menu that uses all of the cuts of the pork. So, for instance, when you dine at Epiphany, downstairs it's got the pork feature, which is a rotating seasonal menu item that has different cuts from the center of the pig, and then a lot of the things like the dumplings or the ramen or the pizza, like those things have other cuts. Maybe it's the sausage or it's ground or it's the belly that's on the ramen or it's the neck and the shanks that go into the dumplings. Like, so by having a diverse menu mix, we can utilize more of the animal. Same thing here. It's like with chickens, we have no problem utilizing the chicken, but we have a lot of necks, we have a lot of feet, we have a lot of livers. And so this menu is being like kind of engineered to utilize the things to allow our farming practices to be more sustainable. And that's really one of the reasons. The other reason is that if we were to just go after economies of scale and just spread out, which we've looked at, possibly going to Peoria or Champaign or Springfield or other markets, middle-sized markets with the same concepts we already have, whether it's an Anjou Above or an Epiphany Farms or like an Anjou Express or something like that, then we get spread out geographically. And that is something that we have decided we want to not do because we like being in proximity to the land and to the farm, and we like being able to work on, as one team.
Do you find yourselves competing with your other restaurants?
I think it could be a problem, but I don't think we look at it as that. And so, I mean, even with other restaurants in the area, I don't really feel like we compete. We're all kind of playing our part in the community, but it is thought about when we do the menu design and when we decide on what we're going to be offering at each location. We've kind of taken the premise of like, let's move into these old buildings, let's give them new life, let's upcycle them, kind of like our farming techniques. It's like we're doing old things, we're doing things that we were doing, you know, early 1900s, and you know, we're in these old buildings. I think this building was like 1905 or something like that, and Epiphany was 1902, the old Bank of Leroy was 1919, and so like giving them new energy. But since you're not designing the build out around the concept, you have to kind of reverse it. You have to live in the space, understand the space, figure out what the space is really playing towards, and then execute the concept. And so we lived in this space as a bakery for 2.5 years, and we've thrown all sorts of different ideas of how we're going to do this. And now Bakery and Pickle is a representation of our efforts as a team to craft this experience. And so we don't necessarily force it. I mean, one of the design principles we follow is to accomplish the most with the least amount of impact or the least amount of effort. And so that's really what this space is. And the other thing is, it's also a long-term strategy for us because we know that our company has to continue to evolve. And we have some ideas of how we want Epiphany Farms to evolve, that restaurant. And we're hoping that this Bakery and Pickle being open, offering this type of experience, is going to take a little bit of pressure off of Epiphany Farms and allow Epiphany Farms to continue to evolve.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen. We're talking with chef co-owners Ken Mishka and Stu Hummel about Epiphany Farms Hospitality Group's new restaurant opening in downtown Bloomington. So we talked about it a little bit before, but there's an increase in small business restaurants over corporate chains. Epiphany Farms is a major contributor to that with its constantly growing local ventures. Why is the rise of these small business restaurants so important to the local economy?
As people start to understand where the food comes from and how important nutrition is and how food is prepared and the practices in which animal husbandry comes into play, that affects where people are going to spend their food dollars. Epiphany Farms represents something that we truly care about, and that's being stewards of the land as well as being awesome culinarians and creating these awesome experiences for people. And we're fortunate enough to have the opportunity to now have nearing 200 employees around us that all have the same beliefs and principles that we do. And that's the most important thing in my life, in my opinion, is to really stand behind something that we feel proud of and to be able to educate people on their food choices and where they spend their food dollars and why it's important to support small businesses and to help the community grow. And understanding that as people spend their money within this community, it strengthens it time and time over.
Downtown Bloomington seems to be constantly revitalizing itself. And what does the addition of Bakery and Pickle do for the area?
Bakery and Pickle will strengthen the downtown Bloomington, how should I say, food scene, if you will, which there really isn't much of a food scene in downtown Bloomington. I'll give a shout out to Night Shop, who just opened about 6 months ago. There's multiple businesses that are starting to migrate back downtown, and I think that we can bring a lot of action and life to this space. We need more commerce. We need more small business. Hopefully, the Bakery and Pickle will strengthen Epiphany Farms brand image, and I like to think that we have the reputation of, oh, Epiphany Farms, they're going to take care of us, or they provide the best hospitality, or they have all my favorite restaurants, not just Epiphany Farms, that's my favorite, Orangi, that's my favorite. It's like everything they do, everything they touch, golden. So we're going to continue to expand upon that image and in that mindset, and bringing the team down here and kind of figuring out how this whole process is going to work is our next challenge. And then once we conquer this one, on to the next.
A lot of this is like, how do you preserve that feeling of Lancaster's? You know, the college student wouldn't walk into Lancaster's because it was a fine dining restaurant. They're not necessarily going to walk into our restaurant because it looks like it's a closed antique shop. But every bar you go to downtown, you have that wave of Uber drivers and college students and buses. And we've done a great job moving the buses off of Main Street and opening that up for pedestrians. But each bar is just completely flooded with people, and they take advantage of that. And then the byproduct of that is a very unsafe, dangerous, sticky, dirty, smelly, overcrowded location. So I'm hoping that the Bakery and Pickle is going to bring a lot of class and refinement to downtown Bloomington again, because it's hard to find between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. And so I'm hoping that the Bakery and Pickle is this like secret little oasis where local business professionals can come and have a great drink and a good conversation and feel a really awesome vibe and eat food that they would normally have had to drive to Chicago to get.
It's almost like the front of the bakery is a different business than the speakeasy supper club. And you have to know about it to get in. And it probably wouldn't have worked any other way. If the storefront were just a restaurant where you could enter a vestibule to a host stand into a restaurant, you wouldn't be able to create this really special, exclusive feel that I think I don't want to say the upper echelon, but like the doctors and lawyers and people that used to support Lancaster's are really, really thirsty for.
Ken, getting back to a little thing that you hinted at before, this isn't the typical place that a college kid's going to want to go to or that they're even going to be able to get into. Is that part of the reason why we're using such a secretive password? You have to have this password to get in, and only certain people are going to know it, and you have to get it from a certain way. Is this kind of a way to keep the college atmosphere away?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of our workforce is mature college professionals, and so I think, you know, there's a difference between the newly 21 and then the person that's going to school for a master's degree. And so I think the college students with, you know, nowadays with Instagram and Facebook and Yelp, I mean, as soon as this place is open, the cat's going to be out the bag and people are going to know about it. What's going to be funny is that they're not going to know how to get in. And what we've asked them to do is just simply engage. And so there's a phone number for the space. You can't call it. You get a voicemail that says we don't answer it. You got to send a text message. And you send a text message, and then we reply with, send a text message with your first and your last name, the amount of people in your party, what time you'd like to come in, and then your email. And then we'll send you back confirmation password and the time that we can have you in. And then that's how we manage the front door. We can also have walk-ins and things like that, although we do anticipate, you know, the first couple weeks being pretty busy. And we're trying to ramp things up. We're not trying to be too busy and put our staff in an uncomfortable place. And we want to make sure that everyone that does book an experience has a really, really good, well-crafted meal. So I don't know. I think it'll be open. You got to just, you know, you can either book a reservation for the main experience, or you can text the phone number and get the password and come in. We aren't allowing for reservations for the late night yet, but that is something that over time we will.
You've been planning Bakery and Pickle since before State Farm closed its downtown building. How will you succeed with a hit from not having those workers in town?
With the 130,000 plus individuals that are in McLean County, in the surrounding communities of Bloomington Normal, State Farm, it is, it's very unfortunate that they have to release people, but that creates opportunity for other people. There's an experience to be had with Epiphany, and us creating the Bakery and Pickle has been for our loyalists of Epiphany Farms. When you know us, especially personally, when you know our staff, when you know our restaurant, we created this for the people that have supported us for the last X amount of years. And that's cool that we have the opportunity to extend the initial invites to those very, very near and dear to us, to offer the first experiences up to them. And then as it kind of bleeds into the community, we can continue to bring in new people and share and create new experiences. But people Yelp, they have cars, they drive. I go to Chicago when I want to dine. Now I have an awesome, like I have an awesome restaurant now that I can create the food that's kind of risky, little guilty pleasures that I would have to normally go to Chicago for. Now we can offer that in this demographic. So I think that very soon we're going to have people coming down from Chicago to do the, not the bar crawl, but the restaurant crawl of Old Bank for brunch into Anjou for lunch, Epiphany, and late night speakeasy. We can accommodate a pretty serious, a substantial four-stop destination experience here in Bloomington.
Does this venture fit into nationwide trends in restaurants?
Yeah, it. I would say more than nationwide. It's a global trend now. I mean, we were just visiting in Korea last year, and there's multiple speakeasies that are popping up, and it's just, it's kind of cool that it's coming back. It's neat that it's it's interesting. I think nowadays it's not just about a meal to fill my stomach and then go do something entertaining. Go to a movie or go out. You know, it's the meal is becoming more of the experience. You're not just paying for, you know, great food, but you're also paying for a good time and laughter and a place to be. And you know, it's, people want more. And we wanted to change the way a typical meal works. You come into a meal and, you know, you get greeted by an employee. Hopefully they're well trained and they know what they're talking about and they do a great job. But it's like you're kind of getting talked down to by them because they're looking over the table and there's just like this like weird motion thing, and you know, people are reading they're reading the menu, but they're not really reading the mail, or they're not paying attention, and everyone's on their phones and on their Instagram, and it takes them, you know, 5 more minutes now to order than it used to. And it's, I don't know, it's just it feels weird to us, and it's going a weird direction. And so by changing the premise of this restaurant, by turning it into a speakeasy and having a completely different experience, we can kind of change the interaction and the way that the meal happens. And that's what we're most excited about, because you're going to actually meet the server face-to-face. You know, walk into the space and instantly you're going to have a cocktail in your hand. Instantly you're going to get bites of food. Right away you're going to meet the server at the bar area, standing up, you're talking to them, they're going to explain the cocktail program, explain what we're doing. You order your beverage and you get to go back to your, then you go to your table. Once you go to the table, you learn about what the chefs have in store for you. You see what adjustments you can make. You can add supplements. You can expand the courses. You can pick between entrees. And then it's a shared, fun, communal experience. And we want them to leave and be like, wow, that was not only a great value, but that was just a really, really fun time. I remember about 4 years ago when we opened up Anjou, Craig Cahan, who runs all of our events, he was ecstatic. Because all these guests were leaving Anjou, and they kept on saying that was such a fun time. And it's like, what restaurant do you go to and you leave and you're like, that was fun? It's and that's cool. Like, that's what we want, and we want our brand to be known for that. And so I think we're just going to be able to kind of experiment and take it a cool direction here.
That's chefs Ken Mishka and Stu Hummel talking with GLT's Mary Cullen about the opening of the new Epiphany Farms restaurant, Bakery and Pickle in downtown Bloomington. This is Sound Ideas. The theme of the most recent Next to Normal Story Slam was re, as in remember, rewrite, rethink, and any other reword you can think about. John Poling is from Clinton. He gives us this remembrance of a career past from the Story Slam held at the McLean County Arts Center.
Tonight, for me, my re is a trip back in my personal history, which we're going to rewind back to 1993, which seems rather appropriate, the term rewind, because that's my re tonight. So you might think that I was an acne-prone teenager back in 1993, but believe it or not, at that point in time, I was already 29 years old, and I had already careened my career into a rut. I'd had 3 different jobs since I'd graduated from college, and I had loathed every one of them. I had been in sales, in management, and in fundraising. And each and every one of those things I knew I didn't like doing. So I needed a change. I was also very eager to get out of my hometown. Other than a 4-year stint in college, I'd spent the better part of three decades living in the same place. So I was on the hunt for a new job, a new town, a new me. Now, back in 1993, many times there were good job opportunities in something called a classified section of something called a newspaper. And that fall, I had found a doozy. An entry-level management position with a premier entertainment company in America that had something like 3,400 stores and had just bought controlling interest in a movie studio and had a Hollywood production and distribution company. And that excited me. So quicker than you can say 401k with benefits, I had my resume in the mail. Now, back then we didn't have these computers where you'd send off your resume. You actually had to put a postage stamp on an envelope and mail it. And I did. And after a series of interviews where they separated the wheat from the chaff, I made the cut. And so, the U-Haul was rented, and I made my way to Normal, Illinois, to start an exciting new assistant manager trainee position with a Fortune 500 company that had nowhere to go but up. Blockbuster Video. So wait, rewind. The Blockbuster Video that's the butt of jokes today, the Blockbuster Video that only has one location left in the United States today, that's the one. The Blockbuster Video that was mortally wounded by streaming on demand. Oh yeah, that's the one. But this was 1993. And so, the rest of the 1990s is what I refer to as my blockbuster decade. And as I look back and rewind on those times, I realize I have a lot of things to thank Blockbuster Video for. So wait, rewind. What do I have to thank Blockbuster Video for? Well, along with the typical things, which, you know, a decent paying job, a job with the opportunity for career advancement, a fairly pleasant working environment, and if you like movies, one of the best perks of all, 5 free video rentals a week. And I liked movies. I still like movies a lot. But something I also found is that Blockbuster had a fairly decent documentary section, and I first started enjoying documentaries back in college and began checking them out again at Blockbuster, science and nature and history, so I used some of my rentals on those. I also discovered at Blockbuster that I was a pretty good teacher because as I progressed in my career, I ended up training any number of people as assistant managers and CSRs, which were customer service representatives. And I had a number of CSRs that were promoted to assistant managers, and I had some assistant managers that were promoted to store managers and that I had trained, so I was pretty proud of that fact. And as I increasingly did the hiring, I worked with a lot of fun people. And why did I work with a lot of fun people? Because I hired them, and that's one of the reasons I hired them, that they were a lot of fun. And I hired a lot of college kids. I found that I really liked that age group. They had a lot of energy and exuberance, and more of a maturity level than high school kids, but yet they still wanted to have fun, you know? And I went places with Blockbuster, a convention in Las Vegas, and I worked in stores in Lamont and Naperville, and for a short time in Daly City and San Mateo, California. I got around. I even came back for a time to the Blockbuster of my hometown of Decatur. And that's actually during that period where I met the man who would eventually become my husband. So that was a pretty good move on that occasion. So, rewind. Why would I want to leave? You know, it had good pay, opportunity for advancement, the perks of the 5 free rentals, right? Well, it's really no great mystery. It was burnout, you know, kind of what we all get at our jobs, right? Particularly when you work with the public a lot. But there were some other issues as well. You know, in that type of retail environment, I had several employees that had stolen a lot of merchandise and money right out from under my nose. And I didn't see it. Maybe didn't want to see it. I don't know. I was so tired of being lied to by people, right? Oh, I returned that. You didn't get that checked in? What happened there? Oh, I paid that late fee on my previous visit. You didn't get that recorded that I paid that? No, I didn't get that recorded. And so basically the public became my main issue. I loathed them. They began to steal my soul, and I had to get out. And increasingly, the job was more sales-oriented. I think Blockbuster may have seen the writing on the wall, and one of the things that they really began pushing was loyalty cards to sell people these loyalty cards. And increasingly, you know, your reviews were tied into how many cards your store sold and that kind of thing. So by 1999, I was ready to get out. But what did I want to do? Blockbuster had shown me some things that I didn't like, but what did I like to do? Well, rewind. Blockbuster, yes, had shown me some things I didn't like to do, but you know what? They showed me a lot of what I did like to do. Those documentaries, particularly the history ones, reminded me how much I had enjoyed history in college. And training people showed me I was a pretty good teacher. And hiring a lot of college kids, I really liked that age group. So playback. I liked history. I was a pretty good teacher. And I liked college students. Rewind. Was this possible? Was the answer right there in front of me? Was such a broad career transition too much? Was I crazy for thinking about it? Well, what did I have to lose by just applying, right? And so I did. In the winter of 2000, I applied to the Graduate School for History at Illinois State University, and lo and behold, I got accepted. And on August 20th, 2000, I took my first graduate history course at ISU. And let me tell you, that first day, I was so scared and felt like I was so in over my head, I immediately began trying to figure out what was going to be plan B of the biggest mistake that I had ever made in my life. But I stuck it out. And it turns out I had pretty good instincts. I was pretty good at this history thing. And so, on August 18th, 2003, I taught my first history class at Parkland College, Western Civ 101. Wait, rewind. Did I make the right decision? Well, it's 15 years later, and I still teach at Parkland College. And maybe better, I have these two comments from recent student evaluations. Here's the first one. Best history teacher I've had at Parkland by far. But this is the one I really like. John shows some good videos. Thank you very much.
John Poling told his story at the McLean County Arts Center at a Next to Normal Story Slam, organized by Devin Lavelle. GLT will occasionally bring these stories to you during Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas and WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Charlie Schlenker, Mary Cullen, and Eric Stock. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also, check it out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet us your comments using the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington-Normal's Public Media.